SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
Hello, Center for International Maritime Security listeners. My name is Roger Hilton, a non-resident academic fellow for the Institute for Security Policy at the University of Kiel, welcoming you all back for another Sea Control podcast. Before diving into our material today, it is my pleasure to introduce our listeners to the Kiel Sea Power series. With a wealth of information and resources, be sure to visit their website at kielseapowerseries.com for all your information on maritime security. If you are an enthusiastic follower of international relations, or even a fair weather observer, it is hard to ignore the success being heaped on Russia's current foreign policy, and of course its Grand Master President Vladimir Putin. From their cyber prowess to their acute intervention in the Middle East theater, it seems the Kremlin is unbeatable at the moment. Amidst the blitz of publicity, any survey of Russia's power projection would be incomplete without a survey of their naval forces. Here with us today is retired German Navy Captain Klaus Mommensen, who will help us establish if Russia's Navy is a force to advance their great power aspirations or merely a Potemkin projection. His contribution in the Rutledge Handbook of Naval Strategy and Security provides a succinct description of Russian naval history as well as an analysis of its strengths and weaknesses. Captain Mommensen is a graduate of the Military Academy of the German Armed Forces as well as the Canadian Command and Staff College, after which he had spent most of his career in naval intelligence, both as an analyst and in leading staff functions. He has also contributed to Marine Forum, a monthly magazine of the German Maritime Institute, for 25 years. He is also the author of a book on the history of the Israeli Navy. Klaus, it's a pleasure for you to be with us today.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
With choppy waters ahead, no doubt in Russia, based on their impact and growing geopolitical influence abroad, your piece contrasts this with a sobering perception of their naval capabilities, both during peace and wartime, and frankly provides a bleak outlook for the future. History has confirmed that Russia's statecraft is a mixture of a siege mentality perception towards foreigners and the need to dominate their near abroad to guarantee their security, which is often manifested with the use of hard power tactics, as we've seen recently in Georgia and in Ukraine. Before diving into more detail, and could you briefly describe how the current military maritime order is divided?
Well, the Russians certainly can navigate beyond just green water, which means inland waterways, or brown water, which means coastal waters, to the blue ocean. So they have a blue water capability that makes them a blue water navy. They can send task groups or forces all around the world, even conduct combined exercises with friendly navies such as India. So they have a global reach, but they do not have the capabilities for power projection. Russia, in my opinion, and to Mahan's definition, is not a sea power. It's not using the navy to protect its global trade routes, its sea lines of communications outside its regional waters. And with the exception of Syria, has never used the sea beyond mere presence to actively intervene in conflicts abroad.
When you talk about pure power projection, obviously the only country that has true global reach is the United States. But within this category, you have multi-regional power projections, as you mentioned, Russia, India, Italy, Spain, and Brazil. Could you go into a little bit more detail about multi-regional power projection?
Yeah, the Russians are forced to multi-regional power projection because Russia is spanning several regions, but they are not connected regions. Some people would argue that the recent deployment of the Kuznetsov was a power projection from the sea. It was not. It was totally redundant. Ground-based aircraft did the work. They flew over 10,000 or up to, much over 10,000 sorties over Syria, the Kuznetsov only a couple of hundred during the whole 3 months deployment. Just take the sortie rates of other navies aircraft carriers. The new U.S. Navy carrier Gerald Ford will have a sortie rate of up to 207 sorties a day. The Nimitz, in one exercise, managed 197. The French Charles de Gaulle is capable of 100. The Kuznetsov, some analysts say they might generate up to 30 sorties a day, and not on a sustained level. Other nations, other navies are operating globally and are also doing power projection. The French do it. The British Royal Navy does it. The Indian Navy is just regional navy. They are not operating really out of region. So the same goes for some navies in South America, which have blue water capabilities just because they have to deal with large areas of the Southern Atlantic or the Pacific. That is not for the region, not for the Russians.
Klaus, thank you so much for actually distinguishing that a lot of their power projection, in fact, in Syria was as a result of their Air Force sorties and not their naval capabilities. It's often lost in the discussion. Moving forward here, now that we've established that it's not a true power projection tool for Russian foreign policy, can you quickly get into the current organization of the Russian Navy space? Specifically, what are its priorities and areas of interest and its current capabilities?
They are currently organized in four fleets. The Northern Fleet in the Kola Peninsula, the Baltic Fleet, based in the Gulf of Finland and in the Kaliningrad Oblast, the Black Sea Fleet, focused on Sevastopol, in now Russian Crimea, and Novorossiysk, and the Pacific Fleet in Vladivostok and Petropavlovsk. And then they have a fifth fleet, which basically is a flotilla. They also call it a flotilla, the Caspian Sea Flotilla, which is locked in the Caspian Sea. There are some inner waterways where they can transfer ships back and forth, but basically it's not out of region. The current focus is on the Arctic with its vast resources. On the west, Europe, NATO, to counter threats, perceived threats, and the southwest, with the Black Sea being a jump board to the Mediterranean and the Middle East. That is also the only area where Russia currently sees wide possibilities to strengthen its political or military influence.
With that goal in mind about strengthening its influence, what type of hardware and arsenal do the four fleets in Caspian Flotilla utilizing right now to pursue this foreign policy objective?
They have very old warships and weapon systems and very modern ones. Most of their arsenal is more or less outdated, with many ships 30 or more years old. Modernization efforts are underway with focus on blue water capable vessels such as frigates or submarines, which also are useful in regional waters. They have dual use. They are to use in marginal seas and be capable to operate in blue water in the oceans. The future sees new destroyers, cruiser refurbishment, even a new aircraft carrier. But we are talking here of decades to come. Progress is very slowly. The weapon systems are being modernized. Currently, they have new missiles in their arsenal. We all noticed the testing or test fires or demonstrations of their caliber cruise land attack cruise missiles fired from the Caspian Sea or from the Mediterranean to Syrian targets. Generally, the progress of modernization is very slow. You mentioned Potemkin. Government announces huge progresses with more than 80 ships commissioned in 2016. Well, that was meant for the Russian people. 70 of those warships were just small auxiliaries such as harbor tugs or diver support vessels, small boats. And some people tend to just mention numbers in comparing navies. Say they have 11 aircraft carriers, the Russians have just one. They have 60 destroyers, the Russians have just 8 or something like that. That these numbers do not count. It's the capabilities that count.
Again, Klaus, an excellent observation from your point that it's not the numbers that are important as much as the modernization and capabilities at the disposal of the Russian Navy. Moving on a little bit to their naval history, anybody who's ever visited Russia knows that it's known for its harsh winters and obviously frozen waterway passages, which proves to be a strategic disadvantage. Could you go into detail a little bit about how the geography affects the composition of the Russian Navy?
The whole geography, excuse me, made Russia landlocked. It's only a few months that for where sea territory is viable or had been viable. Under Tsar Peter, the only viable seaport was Arkhangelsk at the White Seas, access only a few months a year. With inland trades, very little developed. You can imagine nobody is going on a horse sledge driving from Moscow to the Far East. Tsar Peter naturally focused on sea trade. He founded St. Petersburg. He saw the Baltic as an exit to sea trade. He had a large commercial fleet and a new Baltic seaport built at St. Petersburg, and to protect these new assets established the Russian Navy. By the way, that is exactly what Mahan had in mind. He said, to be a sea power, you have to have a commercial fleet and navy to support it, to protect it. So Tsar Peter followed Mahan's aspects. Going further down in history, 50 years later, Catherine looked south. She secured Crimea, founded Sevastopol, and got an access to the Mediterranean. All year ice free, though she never managed to get hold of the Turkish Straits. We will come to that later. In 1860, Vladivostok in the Far East was added. It became a main Asia hub for trade. And only in 1916, Murmansk, mostly ice free due to the Gulf Stream, was available to the Russian commercial fleet and naval fleet. All these naval fleets created at these directions, to the west, to the north, to the southwest, to the east, fulfilled merely regional missions. The huge distances forbade any combined operations. They tried it once during the Russian-Japanese War, but failed. This deployment, Baltic fleet all the way to Japan.
I mean, there's no doubt it was a cataclysmic failure for the Russian Navy in the early 20th century when they embarked on that mission. We've established that the principal reason for the expansion of the Russian Navy was primarily motivated by financial gains under Peter. You referred to it briefly, the Treaty of Montreux regulating the Turkish Straits. Could you just go into detail a little bit about why this is so important and impacts the Russian Navy posture?
Some people said the Treaty of Montreux gives the Turks control of the Turkish Straits. It controls whoever is going in to the Black Sea and out to the Black Sea. Regulates the passage of warships. Gives restrictions on numbers, on times. That goes for non-Black Sea residents as well as for those inside the Black Sea. So Russia, for example, has also limitations in deploying its fleet. For example, no submarines may pass it submerged. No aircraft carriers are allowed to pass, even Russians, to pass the Turkish Straits, which, by the way, led to the designation of the Admiral Kuznetsov, which has been built in the Black Sea in Ukraine, as a flight deck cruiser, not an aircraft carrier. And right now, the Russians stick to the Treaty of Montreux. But though it's even restricting their own moves. They see it as a tool to protect their own territory. It's more important to them to keep others out of the Black Sea than to use it for themselves for out-of-area deployments into the Mediterranean or something like that.
Undoubtedly, Klaus, everything you mentioned is valid, but it's important to also assess the redistribution of marine power with new NATO member states, including Romania and Bulgaria, and obviously Georgia aggressively looking to join NATO. So it puts a lot of pressure, I would say, on the Russian Navy in Sevastopol due to these geopolitical factors. One last analogy that would be interesting for the listeners is the comparison between Rome as a land power and Carthage as a sea power. Is this an accurate comparison at all of Russia?
Not really. Rome acted as land power, but geographically, it was not forced to do so. Rome had an outspoken maritime geostrategic location with the Italian peninsula dominating the Mediterranean, sitting in the middle of it. They could have controlled the Mediterranean, but they chose to stay ashore, to be a land power. Russia, on the contrary, is landlocked with only very few access points to the open sea.
Well, it's beneficial for you to clarify that, as it's an analogy that's often promoted inside of Russian media sources. Moving on to the Soviet Union, the emergence of the Soviet Navy and its Red Fleet, apparently from your text, did not change or waver so much from Imperial Russia. Again, what was its existential purpose moving forward?
Primarily to support land forces, securing sea supply routes and protecting the seaside flank. Excuse me.
So like you said, even during the Soviet time, at its nascent beginning, it didn't possess the capabilities to assume a more offensive posture.
An offensive posture, yes, but as to the Navy, just posture, except for the development or the developments of the nuclear ballistic missile submarines. The so-called bastion concept, defense of the homeland, was dominating and has been dominating to date. Increased naval presence abroad is a part of that, but just that presence, no combat operations at all. Once in a while, they used it for political bullying.
Well, it's great you were able to bring up the bastion concept because it really reinforces Russia's siege mentality perception of foreigners as well as their need to dominate their near abroad, if we were to put it into some context. An interesting focus in your text comes with the major changes that took place under Admiral Sergei Gorshkov, who was in charge of the Navy from 1956 to 1985. It's referred to as the Golden Age. Could you provide a little bit of details or elaborate on what major reforms took place under his tenureship?
Some people tend to see this as the moving the Soviet Navy, the Red Fleet, out of the homeland waters to the oceans as an offensive posture. basically, the thoughts behind there were still defensive nature. With increasing range of weapons developed, nuclear missiles, submarine-launched nuclear missiles, aircraft carriers, they could not wait in home waters for the enemy to arrive there. They had to leave home waters to challenge the enemy already in far distance, enemy meaning the U.S. and NATO with them. Could be understood as strengthening offensive capabilities. Actually, they created a deeply layered line of defense, starting in the open Atlantic with submarines and aircraft, anti-submarine warfare aircraft, and cruisers with long-range missiles. All these assets were to counter U.S. carrier strike groups and SSBN, the ballistic missile submarines, to keep them away, out of reach for the Russian homeland. It's protect the motherland's coasts, ports, naval base. The first layer out in the Atlantic, the second layer just north of the North Cape, Then came the Barents Sea, and then came projection of their own ballistic missile submarines as a second strike capability, which were basically holed up in the Kara Sea, in the Arctic waters, out of reach for the U.S. forces.
I think we would both agree that Peter the Great would be envious of Russia's ability at this time to create such strategic depth in countering a much more advanced Western adversary. Against this backdrop, what is the main takeaway, would you suggest, of the USSR's experience at sea for our listeners?
Their aim was, main mission was to protect the core of Russia. They had no real responsibility for maritime offensive operations. The flank protection to the land operations was dominating. Offensive concepts of operations were part of the game. Submarines had to cut off NATO resupply lines, again with the aim to favor their own land forces in Europe. Amphibious operations to gain the Baltic approaches were meant to open up lanes into the North Sea and North Atlantic and use of Baltic rear facilities for logistics and repairs for ships from the Northern Fleet operating there. Ships like Kiev carrier, aircraft carriers, were at the main task to facilitate a quick shift of focus in amphibious operations, just operating off the coast. Secure company land operations from the seaside flank. They were not meant for power protection in other regions of the world. The overall aim was not to expand their operations to the world oceans. They were just integrating the oceans into their own homeland defense.
Great. Klaus, the last thing as we dive back into history, as they routinely say now that we're entering a new Cold War, is would you say that the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 was arguably one of the greatest successes of the Russian Navy, or of the Soviet Navy, excuse me?
Well, it was definitely the greatest achievement in logistics operations. 86 Navy civilian ships. In 183 trips, that's what I just found out at Wikipedia, they transported 42,000 soldiers and 230,000 tons of cargo to Cuba. That was a logistic operation. Again, they avoided military confrontation. The Navy was insufficient to challenge the U.S. at sea, especially when far away from home. So, with only the nuclear option left, they eventually withdrew and backed down.
Well, Klaus, thanks again for providing such an overarching context of sort of the role the Soviet Navy played specifically in the multiple layers of defense and how its greatest success was a logistics operation in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Moving on to the post-Soviet Navy, obviously a lot changed with its collapse. As you mentioned in the text, the Russian Navy was left in a dilapidated state. With the emergence of the new independent republics came the loss of basing rights. What were some of the major operational consequences that the new Russian Federation had to deal with as a result of the loss of basing rights and territory?
We have to just to look at the map to see that they lost major parts of the Baltic and Black Sea coast. In the Baltic, they were driven back to the Gulf of Finland, to the most eastern part of it, and to the Kaliningrad enclave. That's all that was left. The whole Baltic state coast was gone, the Soviet republics. The same happened in the Black Sea. The Crimea went to Ukraine. Georgia became independent. That left Russia a small portion of the Black Sea coast focused around Novorossiysk. And for two decades or so, they made a deal with Sevastopol, a leasing agreement, so they, with the Ukraine, a leasing agreement, so they could stay and use Sevastopol in the Black Sea. What was gone also was all the shipyards in Ukraine. That's where the large combatants, including aircraft carriers, were built. They were gone. And Russia was financially broke. The shipyard industry had to completely refocus. They had no more subcontractors in former Warsaw Pact states, except for Ukraine, which remained the sole manufacturer for gas turbines, a serious mistake to be felt after 2014. Augmented the state was with access to Western technology and lack of funds, they neglected indigenous developments. More than half of their submarines were decommissioned. Large surface combat ships had to be laid up. They had no money to keep them afloat, no personnel to man them. Most ship engineers came from the former Baltic states, from the Baltic Soviet republics. They were gone. They were out of country. They were forced to make do with small combat corps for the fleets, just a few ships, which they put all effort into keep them combat ready. But basically, they remained merely capable of coastal defense.
I mean, there's no doubt, after reading your text, that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, their competency to build ships vanished completely. But what's more exposed today, I think you would agree, is their indigenous development program and their overt reliance on foreigners for both equipment and expertise. Before we get into the strategic reconsiderations and their objectives back to the opens, there was a brief moment of rapprochement of former enemies through joint and multilateral naval exercises. Today, this is something that seems so far-fetched, but maybe for the listeners, you could just go into a little bit of detail about this initiative that was taken immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, the Yeltsin Russia was wise enough to see that it had no chance to survive in continuing confrontation with the West. The confrontation with the West had ruined it financially. Reagan said that the Star Wars brought them to their limits and over their limits. So Yeltsin sought to more engage with the Western powers. The navies also did some programs. They had FRUCUS with combined annual exercises with France, the UK, and the US, where they rotated hosting these exercises through the four countries. They had Pomor exercise in with Norway up there, and they had the Baltops. They even joined the Baltops exercises, which before had been a U.S.-hosted exercises only for NATO partners. And with the development of the NATO Initiative Partnership for Peace, the Russians even joined Baltops. They even joined NATO counter-terror operation Active Endeavor in the Mediterranean until approximately 2008.
As we move forward here on the podcast, like I mentioned earlier, that the third section of your contribution talks about the strategic reconsiderations of the Russian Navy and their motivation to get back to the oceans. You single out two seminal moments for this reformation of doctrine. One is the March 2000 assumption of the Russian president by Vladimir Putin and the subsequent introduction of the 2010 military doctrine of the Russian Federation, which put an emphasis on transport routes for energy resources. What should the listeners know about these two elements?
When Putin came to power in 2000, he first continued the, let's say, friendly relationship with the West, including the Navy, all the Navy programs. The 2010 military doctrine was after Georgia, which was in 2008, if I remember it correctly.
You're correct.
The doctrine puts a focus on the Arctic. Other sea lines of communications are basically out of reach. for the Russian Navy, at least for sustained operations under a real threat. Okay, they did anti-piracy operations off the Horn of Africa, but with the emerging Mediterranean squadron, they had to skip that due to a lack of ships. Controlling sea lines of communications until today is not a mission for the Russian Navy. They do not have the capabilities to do it globally. Arctic, yes, because that is off their own coastline. Some choke points, possibly, but with limits to resources.
Well, thanks for providing some detail and some comprehensive commentary on the issue. If you were to explain to our listeners, what then was the overarching objective of the Putin regime's strategic reconsideration?
To use an to-date phrase, he wants to make Russia great again.
Well, as you say, Klaus, imitation is the greatest form of flattery, but please continue.
He does not like Russia to be called regional power with just nukes. He does not want to be a junior partner in multinational U.S.-led operations or world politics. He wants Russia accepted as a superpower, also at sea, on the oceans. By the way, that was the main reason for the Kuznetsov deployment to Syria, to demonstrate they have the capabilities in a conflict, Syria, that has no maritime dimension at all. You remember, together with the Admiral Kuznetsov, the missile cruiser Peter Veliki was deployed to Syria. But it was not mentioned a single time in any general staff briefings. Even the Kuznetsov, after flying some initial sorties, combat sorties, was totally out of reporting from in the general staff briefings for 2 months. So,
I mean, Klaus, everything you said is very valid, although anybody who was following Russia's naval intervention must take the deployment of their aircraft carrier with a little bit of salt, as photos of it around England with a tug in the event that it would break down really demonstrated that maybe it wasn't such a power projection tool as we thought. And how outdated it was to shoot off the planes for its sorties. Do you have any commentary about the flotillas and their less than permanent presence far from home bases?
Yeah, the new flotilla concept for out-of-area presence was announced in 2012. They said we will create permanent squadrons in several places of the world. The first one was the Mediterranean squadron to be set up and commanded and controlled from the Black Sea fleet. They had in mind that the Mediterranean squadron would be comprised basically of new frigates and submarines, which were under construction then and were thought to be delivered and commissioned around 2014 or even earlier. And they were centered around the Syrian base of Tartus as a logistic hub. At that time, they did not see the detrimental effects of the Ukraine crisis, which only developed in 2014, and the embargoes, which combined with homemade deficiencies in naval shipbuilding, sort of wrecked all their ambitions for out-of-area deployment. In official, they even had to use other fleets to back up for the lacks of the Black Sea Fleet. Northern Fleet and Baltic Fleet units had to deploy to the Mediterranean just to act with the Mediterranean squadron, which did not do anything operational. They just sat there, naval presence. Even the Pacific Fleet had deployed its missile cruiser Variac for some time to be part of the Mediterranean squadron. In official statements, they do not see a limited Black Sea Fleet. For them, the required use of Northern Fleet, Black Sea, Baltic Fleet, and even Pacific Fleet ships was just another demonstration of their growing capabilities for interfleet operations.
Despite all of these official statements, you would assume, though, that it's very misleading to describe them as having high operational interfleet operations, though, Klaus, right?
Yep.
Great. I mean, just very important for the listeners that it's still another example of Potemkin projection. As you said, in principle, the potential creation of the Standing Task Force for out-of-area operations has great merit. But unsurprisingly, it appears as if Russia is far removed from this capability. What has contributed to this impotent initiative?
The permanent squadrons out of area are great merit for political purpose, including propaganda meant for the Russian people, not for the whole world. Naval presence, as they had exercised it in the 1960s, 1970s, in the Mediterranean, was again to become a tool for strengthening political influence, especially in an unstable region such as the Middle East after Arab Spring. That's why they chose the first permanent squadron being set up in the Mediterranean. Inferior combat capabilities don't matter there. It does not matter if you have three or four or five destroyers there or just one. The problem to them, to the whole permanent squadron concept, is they have no sea basing concept. They need access to shore facilities. And they lack, of course, the required number of ships.
I mean, as you said earlier, correct me if I'm wrong, but the only permanent base that Russia has access to is in Tartus in Syria, which is essentially a vassal state now of the Kremlin. In principle, Vietnam has agreed, but as you mentioned in the text, there are other states who are hesitant about providing permanent presence for the Russian Navy. Do you have any commentary to add to this?
Yeah, Vietnam is the strongest candidate, and they have no problems, the Vietnamese have no problems for the Russians to replenish in Cam Ranh Bay. Only they are not at all interested in any sharing of sovereignty, which the Russians want. They want to have their own part of the port where they have full control. All permanent squadrons would meet some logistic support in the region where they have been where they are to operate. So they have been courting Vietnam. They talked to Cuba. They talked to Equatorial Guinea. They talked to Mozambique. They talked to Yemen, even contemplated setting out on a port at the island of Socotra. They even looking now, in my opinion, at a possible Syrian post-Assad option. They even courted Cyprus, which said no, don't like it. And currently, in recent weeks, they obviously focus on Libya, in Benghazi or Tobruk, and are courting the East Libyan renegade government of General or now Field Marshal Haftar.
Klaus, I'm happy you were able to bring up the Libyan situation. Obviously, their mediation with the government, the potential government of Haftar, reinforces their delinquent activity in the political process about assuming peace. As you said, I think it's most likely that that might be the second best option after Tartus if Assad is able to hold on.
And you'll remember that even when the Kuznetsov had ended their deployment to Syria. They even made a short stop off Tobruk to welcome Haftar on board.
Yeah, it's if I remember correctly, I think he had a video link with Defense Minister mm-hmm. Shoigu, but it's definitely something for the listeners to keep a close eye on. Getting back to sort of the countries they had been courting, it's not exactly the most attractive list of modernized and well-funded countries, but it seems to be more blister than anything else, especially given the opening during the Obama administration with Cuba. One last quick one, again, back, is in the post-Georgian conflict in 2008. Obviously, as you know, with their intervention, they now occupy 20% of the territory, especially Abkhazia on the Black Sea and the port of Sukhumi. Do you have any commentary to add to that rapprochement that was officially terminated?
Yes, it was officially terminated, but the problem is there were no real sanctions. It said, okay, we will not exercise with you anymore, and then military cooperation programs were terminated. But after 2 or 3 years, relations were about to slowly returning to normal. That is when then Putin came to power again. By the way, I think after that lukewarm Western response to the Georgia crisis, Putin most probably thought he could also get away with Crimea, just had to overcome a 2 to 3 year lean period, and then everything would slowly return to normal. He would have Crimea and would have won.
I mean, it was definitely a dangerous precedent set by the international community not to respond more forcefully to the essentially annexed territory of Georgia for 20%. Klaus, in the interest of time for our listeners, as we only have 10 to 12 minutes left, let's fast forward to the fleet renewal program, which composes the last part of it. Of your contribution. As we sort of established right now, financial resources are scarce in Russia. They lack a competency to manage the shipbuilding, and there is a rampant misuse of budget and graft. What would you say then is the current state of affairs and progress of the 2020 state-sponsored shipbuilding program?
The current state is, dire. They are in dire straits. They lack money. They have sanctions in place. The shipbuilding industry is down. Subcontractors are not working anymore. While everyone keeps focused on non-deliveries for Ukrainian gas turbines, there are many other items lacking. It goes from air conditioning, convenience items, diesel engines. They got diesel engines from German MTU. Now they are looking for China, which has been building MTU engines under license agreement. But those engines are 1980s technological standard, so nobody cares whether they get them or not.
Well, hardly a powerhouse on the sea if we're searching for 1980 engines.
Yeah. But subcontractors cannot deliver systems. But that is not only sanctioned systems. Just 2 days ago, there was a report that the commissioning of 2 modern frigates has to be delayed because a subcontractor cannot deliver the air defenses, Russian-made air defense systems for them. They lack skilled workers. The shipyard infrastructure is degrading. There is confused planning. They use overly confident data, probably to save money or to make get contracts, state contracts, and then afterwards have to say, "Oh, we calculated it all wrong," which leads another delays. They have corrupt and incompetent industry bosses, managers, and there are the Russian ministry is very reluctant or not at all paying for military contracts. They have no quality control. Just today there was news that Vimpel shipyard had to pay fines for delivering faulty diesel engines for Grashnok interceptor aircraft. The Northern shipyard, once in St. Petersburg, once one of the most renowned shipyards, had to fire its director for inability to complete 3 Arctic support ships and switch building and completing them to the Antarship at Kaliningrad, where the situation is not much better, by the way. On the other hand, the Admiralty shipyard in St. Petersburg delivered all 6-kilo submarines to Vietnam on time. One reason, most probably, was they have been paid on time.
Well, a small bleaker of hope, I guess, in the native shipyard industry. As we said, the shipyards are incapable of producing indigenous replacements to substitute for sanctions post-Crimea. Despite the apparent amicability between President Trump and President Putin, it looks as if the honeymoon is over. What should they take away in terms of the shipyard industry with this relationship?
They used to announce great achievements, saying we will, in 2017, we will have new gas turbines ready to be built into our new frigates. But only very few indigenous systems have made it to serious productions. There are year-long delays. The gas turbines announced for this year will more likely to be available in 2019. And the problem is not just replacing sanctions good, but lack of quality with their very own weapon systems.
Klaus, the sum total of your analysis paints an unbelievably ugly picture moving forward for the Russian Navy. Despite this, you stated in the book that the Navy expects greater autonomy, flexibility with higher sea endurance, and better sustainability of out-of-area operations. For the last time, based on the constrained financial resources and less than a capable industrial complex, what is the likelihood that this will be achieved?
I do not see them out of the doldrums anytime soon. To the contrary, in my opinion, economic shortfalls will continue to limit defense spending and delay nearly all shipbuilding projects. Just have a look at the oil price. They are much dependent on oil exports, on natural resources exports, energy exports, and the prices are much below what they need to sustain their economy. Just recently, they announced slashing the fiscal year defense budget by 25% compared with 2016. Certainly, this is not driven by a goodwill signal for arms reduction, but by economic shortfalls. We will continue to see several year delays to nearly all shipbuilding programs, at least complex major combat ships. They will roll out small port harbor tugs and small boats on the chain line. Publicly, meaning to their own people, they will claim huge successes. In reality, they will basically stay where they are. For the Russian Navy, that will mean they will stay in the marginal seas, where they will be defending the motherland, and that will remain the main mission. There will be out-of-area operations, but merely in form of cruises, no power projection from the sea. Programs do not foresee, at least as of yet, a major sea-basing capability, which is required for projecting power from the sea.
Well, Klaus, based on our working hypothesis about if the Russian Navy was either a Potemkin or power projection, it seems it's quite evident that it's more Potemkin than anything. If you were advising Russian President Putin, what priorities would you say, and the final operational takeaway for the listeners when they assess the Russian Navy within Russian great power aspirations?
If I were Putin, I would, for the Navy, focus on homeland defense in marginal seas. I would stop bullying neighbors, which could only lead to an arms race. Russia has no chance to win. I would try to mend broken ties. The instruments for dialogue with NATO are still in place. And in some fields, widely aside from public view, Russia is even talking to NATO nations. Just yesterday in Boston in the USA, the Arctic Coast Guard Forum, Canada, Finland, Greenland, Denmark, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the U.S. signed a doctrine on tactics and information sharing for operations in Arctic waters. So Russia is signing a document, a protocol, for combined operations with NATO nations. That is worthwhile remembering. Putin should realize, we all should realize, that Russia is a political superpower with its role in the United Nations Security Council. Militarily, to me, it is a regional power spanning several regions from the Pacific to the Atlantic and to the South. Make a global power only by nukes, except for maybe show of force global deployments. You will not see any power projection from the sea for Russia.
Just to clarify for our listeners regarding the recent contract that was signed with Arctic powers, both Finland and Sweden aren't NATO members, in case anybody was wondering.
Yeah.
Klaus, again, undoubtedly the current Russian statecraft shows no sign of diminishment. Based on the conversation, the lesson for our listeners and for everybody in general might be that before jumping to conclusion about Russia's ascension into the halls of great powers, it is critical to never overlook their Potemkin pasture on the high sea. There's a litany of facts that you mentioned that range from a lack of competency, insufficient funds, and incompetent management, to name a few. Captain Momsen, thanks again for providing such a timely description on the Russian Navy. If you want to follow up on this podcast or other pressing maritime issues, you can find the Rutledge Handbook of Naval Strategy and Security online. And most importantly, don't forget to check out the official Kiel Sea Power website .com for all the latest updates on marine security issues. As usual, listeners, I will be back shortly to discuss more maritime issues. From the Institute for Security Policy at the University of Kiel, I'm Roger Hilton saying moin moin and farewell. Thanks, everybody.
That concludes episode 138 of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guest this week, Captain Momsen, our guest host, Roger Hilton, and our producer, Ryan Yulia. If you enjoyed this podcast and you haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.